Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now going to cover chapter 38 in the prophet Isaiah. I will entitle this chapter Hezekiah's Sickness and Recovery. In our last chapter, chapter 37, Sennacherib, with his 185,000 dead soldiers lying on the ground, had retreated back to Nineveh, and the siege against Jerusalem was over. That was in 701 B.C., but right at the same time, Hezekiah got sick. And so we'll read about this in this chapter, starting with Isaiah chapter 38, verses 1 through 6. In those days, Hezekiah became ill and was at the point of death. The prophet Isaiah, son of Amoz, went to him and said, "This is what the Lord says, put your house in order, because you are going to die. You will not recover." Hezekiah turned his face to the wall and prayed to the Lord, "Remember, O Lord, how I have walked before you faithfully and with wholehearted devotion, and have done what is good in your eyes." And Hezekiah wept bitterly. Then the word of the Lord came to Isaiah, "Go and tell Hezekiah, this is what the Lord, the God of your father David, says. I have heard your prayer and seen your tears. I will add 15 years to your life, and I will deliver you and this city from the hand of the king of Assyria. I will defend this city." Now the events of this chapter, Hezekiah's illness and the sun going back 10 steps on Ahaz's sundial, these events are also recorded in 2 Kings 20, verses 1 through 11. There are some slight differences. So this is pretty much of a rehash from 2 Kings 20. In verse 1, Isaiah says, "In those days Hezekiah became ill." What days? Well, the commentators all agree this is sometime around Sennacherib's invasion in 701 B.C. It is certain that the sickness was in 701 B.C. How do we know that? Because it was in the 14th year of Hezekiah's reign that Sennacherib invaded Judea. Hezekiah reigned between 716 B.C. and 687 B.C. And so if you take 716 minus 14, you get 702, which is close enough to 701 because of when you subtract dates out, you have pieces of years that you have to worry with. So that's close enough. We also know that he died in 687 B.C. If you take 687 and add 15 years, the 15 years that God gave Hezekiah, you end up at 702, which is close enough to 701. So we know that the sickness of Hezekiah occurred at the same time of Sennacherib's invasion in 701 B.C. But now there is a split of opinion on whether this sickness was before Sennacherib's invasion in that year or after Sennacherib's invasion in that year. Well, those who say it was before, the sickness was before the invasion, point to verse 6 in Isaiah 38. This is the word of the Lord that Isaiah was supposed to deliver to Hezekiah. "And I, Yahweh, will deliver you, Hezekiah, in this city from the hand of the king of Assyria. I will defend this city." I will. That sounds like that is going to happen in the future. And so therefore the sickness must have been before the invasion. Now, Ellicott believes that. He says, quote, "On any supposition, the narrative of Hezekiah's illness throws us back to a time 15 years before his death, and therefore to an earlier date than the destruction of the Assyrian army." So, in Isaiah 38, verse 6, the deliverance of the city is spoken of as still future. And I think that's the easiest way to take it. But now there are those who say that Hezekiah's sickness came after the invasion of Sennacherib in the year 701. For example, Albert Barnes. He says, verse 6, where God tells Hezekiah, "I will deliver you, I will defend this city." Barnes says of that, quote, "This may mean simply that Hezekiah would be perpetually and finally delivered from Sennacherib's hand, that Hezekiah would be secure in that independence from a foreign yoke which he had long sought." And that could be. Also, it could be that verse 6 is a promise that Sennacherib would not come back after leaving on that fateful night when 185,000 of his soldiers were killed. So verse 6 could mean this, "And I will deliver you in this city from the hand of the king of Assyria." He's left, he's not coming back. So the commentators split on that, but I tend to think that this sickness was before the invasion of Sennacherib. And if it was, think of what a terrible time it is to get sick. Your nation's about to be destroyed by the mighty Assyrian Empire, and you're sick as a dog. 701 was not one of Hezekiah's better years. So while Hezekiah apparently is waiting for Sennacherib to wipe out his kingdom, Isaiah comes to see him and says, "Put your house in order. You're going to die." Great news. Verse 2, Hezekiah turned his face to the wall. Why would he turn his face to the wall? Probably so he could pray and weep with more privacy. I can imagine there would be attendants all around his bed looking after him, trying to take care of him, trying to ask him what to do about Sennacherib's invasion. And he wants to pray, so he turns to the wall and weeps bitterly. I mean, when Isaiah says, "Put your affairs in order," that's a pretty bitter thing to say and bitter words to hear by a man who's already facing the ruin of his kingdom. Some people say that his sickness was occasioned by the consternation and terror that Hezekiah had received because of the attack by Sennacherib. I don't know if that's so, but I imagine that attack could not help his health any. In verse 3, Hezekiah says, "Remember, O Lord, how I have walked before you faithfully and with wholehearted devotion, and have done what is good in your eyes." And Hezekiah had done that. He had knocked down all the idols. He was one of the good kings of Israel. One might question why he brought up his faithful walk before the Lord at this time. Some have speculated that perhaps Hezekiah thought that he must have committed some awful, enormous crime, and God was punishing him for it. Sort of like Job's friends thought about Job. And Hezekiah might have thought, well, if I did so, I don't know what it was. And so he's asking God to please remember his good deeds that he had done during his life. Or it could be that Hezekiah just thought it was bitter irony that he had been a good king and this happened. He doesn't really think he's committed a terrible sin, but he can't figure out why bad things happen to good people. That's the old problem, the problem of the book of Job. And so not being able to understand why he was going through such suffering, he wept bitterly. Adding to his grief was the fact that he had no son to try to redeem the wreckage of his kingdom. He had no heir. Wikipedia says that Hezekiah lived another 15 years after praying to God. His son and successor Manasseh was born during this time. He was 12 years of age when he succeeded Hezekiah. So that means that it was 3 years before Manasseh was born. And so at the time that Hezekiah is praying, he has no heir. No heir. His kingdom's about to be destroyed, and he's about to die. Well, after Hezekiah prayed, the Lord sent a word to the prophet Isaiah, which shows that prayer does change things. God tells Isaiah, "Go and tell Hezekiah, this is what Yahweh says to you. I've heard your prayer. I've seen your tears. I will add 15 years to your life." Now, Hezekiah at this time was about 39 or 40 years old, and God's going to add 15 years, so that puts him at about 55 when he's going to die. That's still pretty young. But Hezekiah was happy with it. And of course, verse 6, "I will deliver you from the king of Assyria." That was good news too. A word of comfort from a prophet in response to the prayer of a man in bitter distress. We go now to Isaiah 38, verses 7 through 8. God is telling Isaiah what Isaiah is supposed to relay to Hezekiah. "This is the Lord's sign to you, Hezekiah, that the Lord will do what he has promised." Well, what had God promised? 15 more years of life, deliverance from Sennacherib. So what's the sign that God is going to do that? Verse 8, "I will make the shadow cast by the sun go back the 10 steps it has gone down on the stairway of Ahaz." So the sunlight went back the 10 steps it had gone down. Now, this was a sign to Hezekiah. A sign produces faith. Why did God give Hezekiah a sign? It's because he was in horrible circumstances. Just like Paul, when he was on the boat that was going to be shipwrecked, he had a heavenly vision, and he says, "I will follow the heavenly vision to Rome." And he says, this boat will make it to Rome. God, Jesus, came to him in a vision when he was in trouble. That's typically when people of God get visions. Paul was on the road to kill Christians. He had a vision. He saw Jesus. And so that's very typical. I say that because a lot of people have got to have a sign for everything. They can't just pray and let natural providence work out. They got to have something supernatural. Supernatural occurs when natural runs out. If the natural is still here, God will allow us to use natural means. But if natural means fail, then God often will give a supernatural boost to one's life. Now, this is the famous story of the shadow going backwards on the stairway of Ahaz. Ahaz was Hezekiah's father, Ahaz ruled from 732 to 716. That stairway is sometimes called a sundial. I'm just going to assume it's a stairway that had steps that was used as a sundial because there was some pole, the gnomon, they call it, G-N-O-M-O-N. The gnomon of a sundial is the stick that sticks up in the air that casts a shadow on the dial. Well, I'm going to picture here some kind of pole sticking up, casting a shadow on stair steps. That's just a matter of translation, whatever it is. It's the same principle. The NIV has it as stairway and steps, so we'll take it that way. Now, Isaiah doesn't relate some details of this son on the stairway incident, so let's go back and look at 2 Kings 28 through 11. Hezekiah had asked Isaiah, "What is the sign that the Lord will heal me, and then I will go up to the Lord's temple on the third day?" Isaiah said, "This is the sign to you from the Lord that he will do what he has promised. Should the shadow go ahead 10 steps or go back 10 steps? Now, that option given to Hezekiah, it was not mentioned in Isaiah 38. Going back to 2 Kings 20, verse 10, "Then Hezekiah answered, 'It's easy for the shadow to lengthen 10 steps, as the sun would sink in the sunset.'" Obviously, that would make the shadow be longer and then go down the 10 steps. "But no, let the shadow go back 10 steps. Now, that's a problem. So Hezekiah asked for something miraculous. He didn't ask for something that could be answered naturally. And verse 11, 2 Kings 20, "So Isaiah the prophet called out to the Lord, and he brought the shadow back the 10 steps it had descended on Ahaz's stairway." Now, of course, the logical question to ask here is, how in the world did God do that? Now, there are some who say, who cares how he did it? He did it. He's God. He made the universe, and he can do things like that. But I like to go a little bit deeper than that. So let's look at several options as to how God might have performed this miracle. Of course, they're all speculations, but we will look at them anyway. The first option is that God used astronomy, basically, to do the miracle. In other words, he made the earth stop spinning and start spinning backwards. This was such a miracle that it was noticed by other nations. We read in 2 Chronicles 32:31 that the Babylonians knew about this miracle. We read, "When the ambassadors of Babylon's rulers were sent to him to inquire about the miraculous sign that had happened in the land, God left him to test him and discover what was in his heart." Well, the problem with that explanation is, if God made the earth stop spinning on its axis and to reverse, it would destroy everything on the planet. Yeah, the Babylonians would have known about it, all right. So would everybody else. Every house would be flattened. It would screw up the laws of gravity. That can't be it. Here's option number two, refraction. Now, this is more reasonable. This is Adam Clark's view. Let me read you what Jameson Fawcett and Brown says about this. "The retrogression of the shadow may have been affected by refraction, a cloud denser than the air interposing between the gnomon and dial." The gnomon is the stick that sticks up, and the dial, in our case, the stairway. "A cloud denser than the air interposing between the gnomon and dial would cause the phenomenon, which does not take from the miracle, for God gave him the choice whether the shadow should go forward or back and regulated the time and place." Of course, it's still a miracle. "At all events, there is no need for supposing any revolution of the relative positions of the sun and earth, but merely an effect produced on the shadow. That effect was only local and designed for the satisfaction of Hezekiah, for the Babylonian astronomers and king sent to inquire of the wonder that was done in the land." In other words, the miracle was done in Israel. It was not worldwide so that everybody could see it. I think that is a much more reasonable solution provided by Adam Clark and Jameson Fawcett and Brown. Refraction, clouds, made the light go the other way, although scientifically I'm not sure how that would be done. Well, here's some more options. I got two more options from an unknown author on stackexchange.com. The first of those options says that the top of the gnomon simply fell off. That would be a miracle, of course, that it would fall off, but it having fallen off would cause the shadow to climb right back up the stairs. A tall gnomon would cast the shadow down to the bottom of the stairs. And if you think about it, if you take the top off the gnomon, the light hits the top of the gnomon at a lower spot, which causes the shadow not to go as far, which would make it climb up the stairs. It's a simple solution. Now, there's a problem with that, a small problem. How would that be a big enough miracle to attract the Babylonian ambassadors mentioned in 2 Chronicles chapter 32? Well, I thought about that a little bit. I'm speculating here. It could be that the word of the miracle had gotten out and it passed over into Babylon, and they said, well, that's interesting. Let's go check that out. It doesn't mean that the miracle was too small for them. I mean, after all, you pray about it. Hezekiah specifically says, I want the shadow to go back up. And then all of a sudden, miraculously, the top of the pole that's casting the shower breaks off at just the right spot to make the shadow go up exactly 10 steps. That's a miracle. And they wanted to go ask about it. So I like that option. Here's another option from this unknown gentleman on Stack Exchange. He says that perhaps there was a meteor that briefly outshone the sun and caused another stronger shadow that went back 10 steps from where the sun's shadow was. See the Chelyabinsk meteor videos for a recent example of a meteor brighter than the sun. Well, I don't know what those videos are. I'm tempted, if I had time, to go look them up. But that's reasonable, too. Big bright meteor shows up, outshines the sun. The light cast by that meteor is in a different direction than sunlight. The meteor being at a different angle than the sun is in the sky, and that would make the shadow go back up the steps. Well, however the miracle happened, if you believe in the integrity of the scripture, which I do, then the shadow went back up the steps. And if you are a God-doubting infidel who does not believe in a supernatural God, then you will say, well, this is just a story. Now, the latter two options, the top of the gnomon fell off, a bright meteor shower that outshone the sun coming from a different angle. Those two options required one of Hezekiah's servants to be watching the sundial, which is likely because Isaiah had predicted the sign. Or we can just speculate that Hezekiah was looking through his window and he saw it happen. Now, I've been assuming these are stair steps. One of my commentators says that it's stair steps because the sundial wasn't invented till a couple hundred years later by Anaximenes, who was a disciple of Anaximander, one of the pre-Socratic Greeks. However, Adam Clark says, quoting Herodotus, the famous Greek historian, Herodotus states that the sundial and the division of the day into 12 hours was invented by the Babylonians, and from the Babylonians, Ahaz borrowed the invention, his sundial. So, whether it was a sundial or whether it was steps, it doesn't make any difference. It was a miracle either way. We go now to Isaiah 38, verses 9 through 14. A writing of Hezekiah, king of Judah, after his illness and recovery, colon. I said, in the prime of my life, I must go through the gates of death and be robbed of the rest of my years. I said, I will not again see the Lord, in the land of the living. No longer will I look on mankind or be with those who now dwell in this world. Like a shepherd's tent, my house has been pulled down and taken from me. Like a weaver, I have rolled up my life, and he has cut me off from the loom. Day and night, you made an end of me. You, Yahweh, he's talking about. I waited patiently till dawn, but like a lion, he broke all my bones. Day and night, you made an end of me. I cried like a swift or thrush. Thrush is a bird. A swift is some kind of bird, too. I moaned like a mourning dove. My eyes grew weak as I looked to the heavens. I am troubled, O Lord. Come to my aid. Now, what is this writing? John Gill says it's, quote, John Gill says it is a writing, quote, in which the king owns his murmurings and complaints under his affliction and acknowledges the goodness of God in delivering him out of it. This he put into writing as a memorial of it for his own benefit and for the good of posterity. Very probably he carried this with him to the temple, whether he went on the third day of his illness, and hung it up in some proper place, that it might be read by all and be sung by the priest and the Levites. And the prophet Isaiah has thought fit to give it a place among his prophecies, that it might be transmitted to future ages. Well, that's nice speculation. Wherever Hezekiah put that writing, we have it now because Isaiah wrote it down in his book, and we still have the book of Isaiah. And basically, Hezekiah in this paper talks about how miserable he was because he was dying. He says in verse 10, in the prime of my life, must I go through the gates of death? Well, Isaiah, as we know, as John Gill says, and as Wikipedia confirms, Isaiah was about 39 or 40 years old. He was in the prime of his life, and now he's going to die, and that depresses him. In verse 11, he says, I will not again see the Lord in the land of the living. course, that leaves open the option that he's going to see the Lord in heaven, which, of course, he would. But in the land of the living, he's not going to see God anymore. He will not see mankind anymore. In verse 12, he says, like a shepherd's tent. When a shepherd leaves, he pulls up his tent, and the tent is taken down. Like that shepherd's tent, Hezekiah's house has been pulled down. His house, of course, is his body. It's been pulled down and taken from him, or will be taken down and taken from him when he dies. He uses another metaphor to talk about his death. He says, like a weaver, I have rolled up my life. A weaver will take the cloth that he's weaving on his shuttle, on his loom. He'll cut it off and dispose of it, maybe even roll it up. Likewise, Isaiah says, I've rolled up my life. I've been cut off from the loom. I'm finished. The weaver's finished with me. God is finished with me. Day and night you made an end of me, Hezekiah says to Yahweh. Now, there's two ways that that can be translated or understood. Option number one is, in the space of a day between morning and night, you made an end of me. In other words, I don't have very long to live. Between a day and a night, that's what, 12 hours or so? I'm about to go. Now, the Holman Christian Study Bible favors that interpretation. That translation says, you make an end of me from day until night. In other words, from morning till evening, and then I'm gone very quickly. The other option is that God is whipping up on Hezekiah every day and every night. The NIV translation favors this. Day and night you make an end to me. In other words, you're punishing me every day that goes by and every night that goes by. Now, when we get to verse 13, we have a translation issue. Verse 13 says, I waited patiently till dawn, but like a lion he broke on my bones. I waited patiently till dawn. The question is, what is that word waited? What does it signify? How should it be translated? Well, there are three options. Option number one is the KJV. King James says, I reckoned till morning. That is, a lion so will he break all my bones. I reckoned until morning. Well, what does reckoned mean in King James English? According to Gill, it means this. Hezekiah fixed and settled it in his mind that he could live no longer than to the morning. If he lived so long, he thought he should have died before the night came on, and now it was come. The utmost he could propose to himself was to live till morning. That was the longest time he could reckon of. I reckon till morning, KJV has it. In other words, I reckon I can last till morning and then I'm going to die. That's Gill's solution. Option number two, the word waited, as the NIV has, means I composed my mind during the night expecting relief in the morning. Now the NASB favors that. Isaiah 38:13 in the NASB says, I composed my soul until morning. In other words, I chilled out. I got relaxed because I expect relief to come in the morning. Well, that's a whole different feel than the KJV, and Gill's interpretation is that I reckon I could make it to the morning. If one thought that, his soul would not be composed and relaxed. So, composed is option number two. Option number three, Hezekiah is in pain till the morning. We've got four translations that translate it that way or similarly. Bible in Basic English, I am crying out with pain till the morning. God's Word translation, I cried out until morning, as if a lion had crushed all my bones. The New American Bible, I cry out until the dawn. The Darby translation. So let's look at those three options again. Option number one, Hezekiah reckoned till the morning that he didn't have much time left. Option number two, Isaiah composed his mind, put it at rest. I left out the Darby translation, which also supports that view. Isaiah 38:13a, Darby says, I kept still until the morning. I composed my soul. So that's option number two. Hezekiah composed his soul till the morning. Option number three, Hezekiah is in pain till the morning. I have no idea what the correct translation is. I don't think anybody does either. Whatever the verb means, we know that Hezekiah felt like a lion had broken all of his bones. A burning fever will make it feel like one's bones are broken. We can assume that Hezekiah had a burning fever. He had ulcers on him. Who knows what his disease was, but it was pretty bad. In verse 14, he says, I cried like a swift thrush, moaned like a dove. He's in pain. He says, my eyes grew weak as I looked to the heavens. I am troubled, O Lord, come to my aid. So he's crying out in the depths of despair. As John Gill says, his prayers, which were quick and short, and expressed not with articulate words, but in groans and cries, at least were not regular and orderly, but interrupted and scarce intelligible, like the chattering of the birds. Gill goes on to say that his cries were sometimes loud and clamorous, like a crane, when the pain was very acute and grievous, and sometimes very low, through weakness of body, like the twittering of a swallow. Or the moan he made under his affliction was like the mournful voices of those birds at certain times. We go now to Isaiah 38, verses 15 through 17. Hezekiah continues, "But what can I say? He has spoken to me, and he himself has done this. I will walk humbly all my years because of this anguish of my soul. Lord, by such things men live, and my spirit finds life in them too. You restored me to health and let me live. Surely it was for my benefit that I suffered such anguish. In your love you kept me from the pit of destruction. You have put all my sins behind your back." In verse 15, Hezekiah says, God himself has done this. Done what? Well, there are two options there. God has given me the sickness. Poole mentions that as an option. But most of the commentators say that no, God has done this. God has done my healing. Here are the commentators that I have that so believe: Gill, Barnes, Benson, Ellicott, and Pulpit. And Matthew Poole says that this is the more probable option. He does mention it might be sickness. So we're going to assume that Hezekiah is talking about his healing now, and he says, I will walk humbly all my years because of this anguish of my soul, because of what he had gone through. He was humbled, and that's what suffering will do to you. It'll make you humble. Some people have said this is after the third day of his healing, when Hezekiah had gone to the temple to give thanks because he's so joyous now. He's giving thanks. Verse 16, Lord, by such things men live, and my spirit finds life in them too. What things? By what things do men live? Well, things like Hezekiah's miraculous deliverance from Sennacherib, things like Hezekiah's miraculous deliverance from his fatal illness. I'm telling you, when God does something that you think is impossible and you think, I've had it, I'm finished, I'm over, and God does it, boy, does that feel good. Yes, that'll make you live. That'll make you get out of bed in the morning. Now, in verse 17, Hezekiah says, surely it was for my benefit that I suffered. Now, that's the NIV translation. As it turns out, there are three possible ways to translate that verse, and the translations come up with different meanings, so we need to look at that. Surely it was for my benefit that I suffered such anguish. That's the NIV. And what that means is that Hezekiah learned from his suffering. He learned to walk humbly. And of course, theologically and psychologically, that makes a lot of sense. Here are some translations besides the NIV that favor that view. The Holman Christian Study Bible says, indeed, it was for my own welfare that I had such great bitterness. The pain gave him some gain, in other words. The NASB translation has it the same way. Lo, for my own welfare I had great bitterness. Well, that's option number one. Here's option number two. In the past, my peace has been replaced by bitterness. Option number three is, in the present, my bitterness is being replaced by peace. The reverse. So let's look at some translations that favor option number two. In the past, my peace has been replaced by bitterness. King James, behold, for peace I had great bitterness. American Standard Version, behold, it was for my peace that I had great bitterness. Bible in Basic English, see, in place of peace, my soul had bitter sorrow. The Darby Translation, behold, instead of peace, I had bitterness upon bitterness. Well, that's reasonable. Now let's look at the third option, which is, in the present time, right now, my bitterness is being replaced by peace. Adam Clark holds to that. Here's some translations backing this view up. God's Word Translation, now my bitter experience turns into peace. The New American Bible, thus is my bitterness transformed into peace. Now Adam Clark, in holding to that view that Hezekiah's bitter experience will turn into peace in the future, goes to the Hebrew, which I don't know, so I'm just going to read you what he says. Paronomasia, that means a pun. He says there is a pun in the Hebrew. A figure, the pun, paronomasia, which the prophet frequently admits. I do not always note it, because it cannot ever be preserved in the translation, and the sense seldom depends upon it, but here it perfectly clears up the great obscurity of the passage. Well, the passage must be obscure because the translations go all over the place on it. I don't know how the pun backs up Clark's view that it means now my bitterness is being replaced by peace. It doesn't really matter. Now let me repeat the three options for verse 17. Let me read verse 17 again. Surely it was for my benefit that I suffered such anguish. That's the NIV. Option number one, the suffering did Hezekiah good. Option number two, in the past, my peace has been replaced by bitterness. Option number three, in the present, Hezekiah's bitterness is being replaced by peace. I report it, you decide. In verse 17, Hezekiah says that in God's love, because of his love, God kept him from the pit of destruction, and also God put all his sins behind God's back. Well, if you put something behind your back, that means you can't see it. And that's what Hezekiah is saying here, is that God has put all of Hezekiah's sins behind God's back, so God can't see Hezekiah's sin. And of course, God does not have a back. This is an anthropomorphic expression. We go now to Isaiah 38, verses 18 through 22, and we will finish this chapter. Hezekiah continues. This is his writing that he perhaps put into the temple. For the grave cannot praise you. Death cannot sing your praise. Those who go down to the pit cannot hope for your faithfulness. The living, they praise you, as I am doing today. Fathers tell their children about your faithfulness. The Lord will save me, and we will sing with stringed instruments all the days of our lives in the temple of the Lord. Now, I don't know when Hezekiah's writing stopped. It might have stopped right there, or he could have gone on to verse 21. Isaiah had said, prepare a poultice of figs and apply it to the boil, and he will recover. And so it could be that Hezekiah included that little fact in his writing that he may have deposited in the temple. But at any rate, by verse 22, the writing of Hezekiah is over with. Now in verse 21, we read, Isaiah had said, prepare a poultice of figs. Why the figs? Option number one, it was a natural help to divine healing. Option number two, it was not a help to divine healing. It was a sign of recovery, which helped Hezekiah believe. And option number three is it's both a natural help to the divine healing and also a sign to Hezekiah to help him believe. So option number one, the figs naturally helped in this divine healing. This is supported by Barnes, who says, there is no improbability in the supposition, nor does anything in the narrative prohibit us from supposing that natural means might have been used to restore Hezekiah. The miracle consisted in the arrest of the shade on the sundial and in the announcement of Isaiah that he would recover. So Barnes says that the figs healed him of this disease. Now, I don't know about you, but it seems to me it's very unlikely that figs are going to heal something as bad as Hezekiah had. This was a fatal illness. He was dying from whatever he had, and figs are going to cure it? I don't think so. I think Barnes is off the wall here. Option number two, the figs were not meant to aid in the healing, but they were rather a sign of recovery, which helped Hezekiah believe. This is John Gill's view. He says, quote, not from the natural force of these figs, but by the power of God that this cure was effected. For without that, it was impossible so malignant an ulcer and so deadly a sickness as Hezekiah's were could have been cured, and especially so suddenly. Nor were these figs used as a medicine, but as a sign of recovery, according to the Lord's promise, and as a means of assisting Hezekiah's faith in it. Well, to avoid a false dichotomy, there's option number three. Perhaps the figs helped in the divine healing, and maybe they were also a sign to Hezekiah to help him believe. Ellicott holds to that. Let me quote from him. The divine promise guaranteed success to the use of natural remedies, but did not dispense with them, and they, like the spittle laid on the eyes of the blind in the gospel miracles, were also a help in the faith on which the miracle depended. Just like Jesus, he rubbed mud mixed with spit in a blind man's eyes. Why did he do that? Well, it was to help his faith, I guess. That's a difficult passage. But likewise, you could say the figs on Hezekiah's boils did the same thing. Hezekiah looked at that and he says, okay, those figs are going to bring life to me through Jesus. Through Yahweh, excuse me. As I think about this, it could be that the figs were used sort of as a mopping up operation. God's healing the ulcers, but maybe there's some pus or something draining out of it, and they have to soak that up, so they put the figs on there just to take care of the secretions coming from the wound. So the wound was supernaturally healed, but there needed to be some mopping up operations done. At any rate, Hezekiah is healed. In verse 22, Hezekiah had asked, "What will be the sign that I will go up to the temple of the Lord, go up to praise God that he's been healed?" You notice how as soon as he gets healed, he praises God. There are a lot of people, they have foxhole religion. They pray, oh, God, don't let the bomb hit my foxhole. Then they survive the war, and they go home, and they live like hell. That reminds me of that California Christian who used to be an Olympic runner, and he ended up getting shot down in the Pacific Ocean. Unbroken, I think, was the name of the book. I forgot his name. It's an Italian name, and he floated in a boat all the way across the Pacific Ocean. The currents carried him with no food, no water. One of his fellow survivors died on the trip. He ends up in a Japanese prisoner of war camp. He goes back to California. He survives all that, and then he starts living like hell. Now, he later repented, and he was a godly man, a very powerful Christian in his testimony. But I just say that because there are some people who, when God does something for them, they don't give him thanks. Hezekiah did, though. Hezekiah had asked, "What will be the sign?" That, of course, is referring to the sun going up the steps or up the sundial backwards. Ladies and gentlemen, on this triumphant note, we have now finished with Isaiah 38, and we are now prepared to go to Isaiah 39, which I will entitle Envoys from Babylon. Some more foreign affairs are going to be covered in the next chapter, and I hope you stay with me for that, and I hope you enjoyed this audio.